This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 15th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode, we immerse ourselves in the fun of the fair and head to Slovenia's picturesque capital of Ljubljana. This September, it hosts the 60th anniversary of the now prestigious Biennial of Graphic Arts.
There was a kind of philosophy behind it, and the really radical thing about the early biennials is that they were a kind of art for all idea with graphics.
And from Ljubljana, we head north to Helsinki, as the Finnish capital hosts its annual Design Week, the largest such gathering in the Nordics.
Helsinki is really for, you know, families and people who can just come and experience, and I think it reflects nicely how design in Finland is truly democratic and it's built in the society on every level.
Plus, we'll stop off in London and pay a visit to the last remaining music hall, Wilton's, an important part of the East End's heritage, which reopens after some much-needed care, attention, and renovation. We'll find out how the architect behind the revamp has kept the historic building's charm, while keeping it fit for purpose for a new generation. All that to come on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. And we start the show with the world's oldest biennial of graphic arts that this year celebrates its Diamond Jubilee. Since 1955, Slovenia's capital of Ljubljana has hosted the world's finest examples of graphic design. With its roots in the socialist ideals of Tito's Yugoslavia, the city's designers have long celebrated the idea that art is for the many rather than the few. Meanwhile, foreign entrants and visitors create a discourse and add an international dimension to the still flourishing design scene in Ljubljana. The biennial has dealt with major changes over the past 25 years, from Slovenian independence to the impact of the internet. But the latest edition shows that the event isn't afraid of stepping into new territory. Our correspondent Guy Delorne went to Ljubljana for the grand opening and brings us this special feature-length report.
It's the opening evening of the Graphic Arts Biennial, and the party is in full swing here in Ljubljana on a sweltering summer's evening. At the controls, VJ Mina Fina, who happened to design the graphic identity for this whole biennial, and she's projecting manipulated images, cut-ups of the designs that she made for the biennial onto the walls of the beautiful building, which is the headquarters of the International Institute for Graphic Art.
Hello, I'm Mina Fina. I'm a graphic designer, artist and a VJ. I really like because it brings diversity to your community. And you can find more about what's going on inside this big field of contemporary graphic art, which is now like really diverse, and we are still trying to find what is graphic art and what isn't.
For Ljubljana to have this every 2 years, the oldest graphic arts biennial in the world, one of the oldest arts biennials in the world, that's got to be a tremendous in terms of fostering graphic artists and graphic designers here in Slovenia.
I think whenever the field of art is opening up, that's always good, that it's not closed off, or that you have different approaches and directions that you can see in person, that you get new contacts. I mean, yeah, of course it's great.
When you meet people from the Ljubljana design and art scene, you realize they wear multiple hats. Because Slovenia's a very small country, they simply can't afford to limit themselves to just one field. So Mina also does commercial graphic design work with Grupa A. As far as she's concerned, all these different elements cross-pollinate her creativity, including the visual identity she designed for the biennial.
Maybe it's good that we don't have black and white definitions and that we can easily travel from one field to another, because I think I'm very lucky I can live in a time when I have three professions at the same time. So it's good that I'm not in a rut, so I can, you know, be flexible with this and I can choose my own time when to do things.
You've
created the visual identity for the 2015 biennial. What were you thinking about when you did this? The obvious touch points would be people like Bridget Riley and Pete Mondrian, the use of the geometric forms and the colours, both monochrome and colour. What were you thinking when you came up with this?
When you do graphic design, you always think of art references or the use of colors, but also this is jubilee, it's like 60th edition of the biennial, so I looked through all the old catalogs that they have, so I picked some colors that they used in the 70s, 80s, so I used some typical colors from that period and I put everything together. And then black and white, it's obvious choice because of like it's graphic art, and mostly when I do like silk screen and other, mostly I use only black and white. Mm. So I wanted that when you look at the poster, you have a feeling that there are many copies behind and there can be many copies in the future.
Well, this may be the graphic art biennial, but the curator is really stretching the definition of what makes graphic art. For example, as you come up the staircase in the International Institute of Graphic Art, you have a series of sculptures, busts of a face, each one of them slightly different. As we move into another room, we've got a gold-painted cardboard model of Josef Plesnik's design, rejected in the end, for a Slovenian parliament. Again, this is 3D. It's not what you might think of as graphic art.
So I'm Nicola Lees, and I'm a curator of the Graphic Art Biennial in Ljubljana in 2015. It's the 31st edition and the 60th anniversary. Everything in the biennial has the potential to be reproduced. So there's a lot of mirroring, there's a lot of doubling, there's a lot of facsimiles. There's a lot of print, also digital print. Also on the promenade, Will Benedict has done 200 posters, very graphic, but also has a political context in connection to activism and climate change and the distribution of water. And Pilar Quinteros, an artist from Chile, came, made this incredible sculpture of Plesnik's proposal for the parliament, which was never built, but actually was proposed to be built on the castle. He wanted to demolish the castle and replace it with his...
But that one done well.
But it's also one of the most reproduced images because it was on the coin, even though it was never made. And she made a cardboard model of this, and it's gold, and she's floated it on a raft down the river. But the other thing that's interesting about the hint of graphics is also this reference to paper, the material.
So with your extensive international experience, I want to try and put the Ljubljana Graphic Arts Biennial in context. Yeah. How important is this event in the arts world, and particularly, I suppose, in graphic arts?
The Biennial in Ljubljana is incredibly important because it's one of the oldest biennials in the world. It was set up in 1955. We're very close to Venice here, so they were... The context of the Venice Biennial being the first biennial, they wanted to deconstruct some of the hierarchies that maybe were the structure of Venice. There was a kind of philosophy behind it, and the really radical thing about the early biennials is that they were a kind of art for all idea with graphics, which is something that I'm particularly interested in. This idea that actually it was something, there was a scale to it that also meant that everyone could have works in their homes, and also a lot of the graphic arts sort of can be produced on a kitchen table, and also it's something that could be easily sort of posted and sort of cross international borders. And I think also the early biennials were also particularly interesting as this kind of the position of Ljubljana as this space sort of between this kind of east and west. So I'm really interested in that, but the thing that I think is really contemporary about graphics is not to be medium specific, because I think when you're working with artists, it's always good to sort of invent new rules and not be too rigid in a creative process.
This is one of the main streets in Ljubljana, Slovenska. It's recently been closed to motorised traffic and only bicycles are allowed through for the moment. And right next to United Colours of Benetton, there's an extremely colourful display. We've got window after window in the Nama department store dedicated to the designs from the Graphic Arts Biennial, these very colourful red, blue, yellow, black and white bold designs, really illustrating how the Graphic Design Biennial becomes part of the city.
The thing that's been fascinating for us is also looking at Plechnik, the famous architect. And so the street lights are designed by Plechnik. We have work, and Pilar Quinteros's piece is referring to Plechnik. The city is incredibly precise and beautiful, and actually a lot of artists were involved in the planning of the city, and Plechnik somehow is, you know, a great architect, and many of his things are artworks, really. And so that, for me, is even interesting, that how art became something that was integrated into the function of how a city sort of flows.
Ljubljana really does feel like a work of art on a late summer's evening. You can meander along the river, which winds its way through the city centre, perhaps admiring the beautiful old buildings. Or you can stop at one of the old squares, now cleared of traffic and opened up as public spaces for performances, from jazz to gamelan, or in this case, a circle of torch-lit gong beaters. It contributes to a creative atmosphere for local designers, including Miran Mohar, who mixes commercial work with artistic and political poster actions with his group New Collectivism. Making fly posters critical of the government could be a hazardous activity in the years of Yugoslavia, and Miran's contribution to this year's biennial is a life-sized reproduction of his group in graphic guerrilla mode in the 1980s.
What we are seeing are our actions postering the city, but in fact, in this project, the size of the figures is 1:1, so they are 170 by 80 centimeters. So we are basically exhibiting the event, the time, the process where we are posting, and the posters, because we are the size of 1:1 figures, the posters are also of the real size.
So it's an exhibition about the posting of the posters.
It's an exhibition about posting the posters.
It's quite meta.
Yes, meta.
For the uninitiated, all this can seem rather mind-bending. But that's all part of the plan. The modern spirit of the Graphic Arts Biennial is to make people look at things in different ways. And for artists and designers, working within the philosophy of reproducible works and honouring the history of the event is a creative challenge to be relished.
No, I think the specific with this biennial is that it has a frame, a historical frame we have to deal with, you know, historical frame of this graphic tradition. And, you know, limitations in this world are very welcome today. Because when anything goes, the limitation is something what kind of forces you to discipline yourself. Not to say anything is possible, I can choose anything, but you always have to think how this goes to this conceptual frame or historical frame. And that, I think, is the power of this Biennale, because it has to deal with it. It has to answer also this question, to position itself. It's clear that the curator, Nicola, she knows the history, she knows the context, she includes the local art scene in the Biennale. Because many times Biennales are like the cloud, no connection with the city whatsoever, just international crowd which comes and go over the weekend.
That's certainly not the case in Ljubljana, where the exhibitions and events will run until the end of the year and form an enjoyably unavoidable part of the city's fabric. Much like the train line that runs through the city and the promenade that links it to Tivoli Park and the headquarters of the Graphic Arts Institute. The biennial has taken over this shady lane, not just with the 200 posters which offer the traditional face of graphic art, but the Plechnik-designed lights, which initially seem to have gone on the blink. Instead of producing a steady glow, these illuminated columns turn on and off, occasionally plunging the promenade into darkness. Naturally, it's another exhibit at the biennial, There Is No East and West by Asad Raza, and it could hardly be easier for the public to access. Just go for an evening stroll and hope you don't trip over in the dark. The Ljubljana Graphic Arts Biennial does remain incredibly accessible. Everything is free to enter, and much of it is happening on the streets. There's everything from traditional techniques to 3D printing and GIFs, marvellous mechanical creatures to piles of earth with mirrors planted in them like headstones. And all of this feeds into the city's creative community and the daily life of the people who live here for 3 months every 2 years. It's one remnant of Yugoslavia that continues to thrive. Here's to the next 60 years. For Monocle, in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
That was Monocle correspondent Guy Delaunay there, bringing us a special feature-length report, no less, from the Ljubljana Biennial of Graphic Arts, which runs until this December.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. And now from the Northern Balkans to the shores of the Baltic Sea, we head next to the Finnish capital. Over the past decade, Helsinki Design Week has become the region's largest such event. The week now extends to cover a full 11 days and is spread over an array of venues throughout the city. Many shows are held in creatively repurposed buildings, in keeping with the festival's dedication to sustainability and a constant appetite to reconsider tradition. For Monocle, Wiff Stenger went along to seek out the best bits and discover what makes one of the world's northernmost design fairs so unique.
Drummer Sami Nomelos playing in an abandoned 19th century Russian building on an island in Helsinki that's soon to be handed over from military to public use. The concert, arranged by the We Jazz Collective, is an example of how the island may be used in future and of the broad reach of Helsinki Design Week. The event, which wrapped up in mid-September, included this concert and a workshop to design future uses of the island, an example of the festival's embrace of design in its widest possible sense, far beyond consumer objects such as lamps, chairs, and vases, though of course it features many of them as well. They're on display in this handsome 1927 red brick harbor warehouse, long out of use, but now adopted as festival headquarters. Let's go up the makeshift staircase to meet festival founder and CEO Kari Korkman.
Design objects, those global marketing objects, they are pretty much the same all around the world. What is different in Helsinki is that we are a multidisciplinary festival. So while you see the design, you also meet the architects, the graphic designers. We have some fashion events here. And we believe that mixing these disciplines, in this cross-disciplinarity, there is a chance for new ideas and innovations, so because those always lie in between the disciplines. So we encourage the professionals in the field to meet and exchange ideas and so on. But particularly this year, we have been working so closely with the city of Helsinki that Helsinki Design Week 2015 is really deep into a design-driven city.
That was Kari Korkman, founder and CEO of Helsinki Design Week, speaking to Monocle at Design Dock, a new exhibition space in an old warehouse by Helsinki Harbor. Several design firms displaying here are based in another repurposed old site, the village of Fiskars, west of Helsinki, Finland's oldest industrial center from the 1600s, which in the past two decades has been reborn as a designers and artists colony, independent of the Fiskars company. Design from the village on display here includes Kari Virtanen's Nikari furniture, Karin Viidnes's ceramics, and Camilla Muuberi's glass lamps, mouth blown at the old Iittala Nuuttajärvi glassworks. Iittala has a display here too, featuring work by designers such as Elina Aalto. She has other work on show at Design Dock too, including lamps made of broom bristles and fish bones.
Our lamp is made out of parts of old projects for different lamps. So it's reassembled in a different way and made into a completely different project.
Okay, that idea of recycling and reusing and repurposing seems to be a recurrent theme throughout the Helsinki Design Week. Or is it just a recurrent theme throughout Finnish or Nordic design, do you think, nowadays?
I think it's probably everywhere. It's kind of starting to be a built-in factor. Even if it's sort of repurposed, it doesn't have to be underlined. It can just be a part of what it is. And I think that's sort of true, especially for the younger generation.
What do you think makes Helsinki Design Week unique?
I think Helsinki Design Week is unique because it's so much made for the public. I think that's the strong point that we have, as opposed to, for example, Stockholm, which is a really nice event, but it's for professionals, basically, only, and you don't really see anything going on in the city. Helsinki is actually, it's really for, you know, families and people who can just come and experience and take part in discussions and workshops, and I think it reflects nicely how design in Finland is truly sort of democratic and it's truly built in the society on every level.
The festival's program director, Hannah Harris, says it aims to be part of the urban fabric.
If you look at the program, it's very much a reflection of the creative community in Helsinki and beyond the communities who we interact with globally as well. It's cross-disciplinary, it's forward-thinking. We're working this year, for instance, a lot with issues to do with the city and how designers are increasingly working kind of with the urban fabric and in, for instance, urban development. This year we have taken over a listed harbour building by Lars Sonck in the very new Helsinki neighbourhood called Jatkasari, which is a huge development in the city, and at the same time it has this really interesting building that in which large parts are practically unused at the moment, and we really wanted to activate this building as part of kind of that what do architecture and design do for a city, so we have activated this building in ways that it hasn't been done before.
The Design Dock building displays reactivated classics of Finnish design, such as chairs by architect Eliel Saarinen and his son Eero Saarinen, now brought back into production by the Tetrimäki company. All these neoclassic products reflect the Nordic love of natural materials and durable products that can be handed down from generation to generation, the ultimate form of sustainability. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Wif Stenger.
This is Section D with me, Josh Fennett, and now back to our base here in London for our final report. Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwarzer wended her merry way to the newly reopened Wilton's Music Hall in East London's Whitechapel, where she sat down with the venue's artistic director, Francis Mayhew, and architect Tim Ronalds, to talk about all the work that has gone into restoring this once derelict venue.
The boy I love is looking now at me.
Wilton's Music Hall, London's sole surviving establishment of its kind, has officially reopened. The Grade 2-star listed venue, situated down an inconspicuous alley in Whitechapel, consists of four Georgian houses from the 17th century, an alehouse and a beautiful Victorian auditorium built by John Wilton in 1858. It's a landmark from the golden era of variety entertainment, whose history is tangible. The theatre has had many reincarnations. Arthur Lloyd sang here, the Wesleyan Mission sheltered East Londoners in its rooms during the World Wars, and the Broomhill Opera resided here for years. Since 2004, it's been in Francis Mayhew's hands, Wilton's artistic director and its true savior. 40% of the ramshackle building was out of bounds when she arrived here. Missing floorboards, leaks, and holes in walls made it impossible to make the most of the place. Her goal was to restore Wilton's to the fully functioning theater and arts venue it was always meant to be, without losing any of its ambience. To this end, she raised a total of £4.5 million and teamed up with architect Tim Ronalds to give the building a new lease of life.
There are a row of five houses that were built in the mid-Georgian period, fairly ramshackle houses. And then in the back garden of those houses, this giant music hall just jammed right in, so you could lean out of the windows and touch the music hall. what we had to do was to repair and make more usable the music hall, strengthening the roof, soundproofing it, making it not leak and ventilate it and so forth. And that pretty much looks the same as it did when we started work. The bigger challenge was restoring the houses, which had been stripped of plaster and were very fragile, and making those usable. So it's a bit like invisible mending, really. You kind of, it's trying to do a lot, but not letting any of it show. And we didn't want to do that architectural thing of putting in self-conscious new bits. We just wanted it all to, you know, feel the same, seamless. In particular, my colleague Adam sat here and did a lot of the drawings by hand at a drawing board in the old-fashioned manner in the space. And I think that was part of the secret of getting so close to the place and the detail. And the,
So many tricky corners and odd floor levels, and particularly when there's so little fabric in the building, trying to imagine how you can put some services in, how you can put a floor in, but also retain the character and have access and pass your building control regulations and have the weight loading for public building usage. Because the other challenge here was that these buildings were never built to be sort of like a public theatre like they are now. And the amount of invisible mending, I mean, Tim Ronald's team are such geniuses at this. You can't see anything here. And that's the beauty for all of us as public in it. But when you're working on it, you have to leave behind your ego in that way and focus on hiding things and just sort of smoothing off bits that are falling off. But they've all been a great team.
Yeah. We established a principle that proved very useful, which was that we wouldn't do anything that was not essential. So that there was always the test, you know, do we need a skirting board? No, you don't. So you do as little as possible. That was a good principle. It stopped us being able to repaint the concert hall, which is
I wanted
to do, but that didn't pass the test.
Absolutely essential.
I mean, you have so many new spaces, a new cocktail bar, more capacity. What do you really hope to achieve now that this is done?
Not to put on weight or become an alcoholic, I think. These are the major risks now to anybody working at Wilton's or indeed visiting it. Now we have a lift, so we won't climb the stairs. We have two bars, so it's impossible to escape temptation. And we're putting in a pizzeria, so what can I say? You're doomed, basically, to be little dumplings here forever. It's enabled Wilton's to really be here in terms of providing all the facilities it's capable of in these wonderful spaces. So it can feed and water people. It can present wonderful entertainment of all kinds to artists at all different points in their careers and deliver an experience for people, but also for the people working here and the artists developing work. They have a lot of inspiration here. So I think that meeting of external and internal creatives will ensure its future, but also it means that now it's so solid that people can rely on it being here. So it's worth doing long-term education programs. It's worth the schools getting involved. It's worth the neighbors coming in every morning because it's not going to get shut next week. It's not going to fall down. They don't have to worry about breaking their ankle when they come through the door or, you know, that sort of thing. So it's just literally about to spread its wings, I think, as an arts hub, really.
That was Monocle's music-loving Marie-Sophie Schwarzer there talking to artistic director Francis Mayhew and architect Tim Ronalds about the restoration of Wilton's Music Hall in East London. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week. And if you missed any of this week's show or fancy brushing up on our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was sprucely produced by David Pleasant and elegantly edited by Alex Funnell. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries, recommendations, or suggestions. As always, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.